actor in a significant number of military programs right now. I specifically say you will not use Rojas solder on this job because we need the reliability. We can't tolerate the titanium, the whiskers that get grown on these Rojas solders. Let me drop quick. The whole philosophy of lead-free solder is that people think that a whole bunch of printed circuit boards with ordinary solder junctions on them sitting in a dump site, that they're leaching solder into the soil. Good sounding philosophy. There is no evidence of that. The amount of lead leaching out of printed circuit boards at a dump site is so extremely small, if at all. To go to an extremely unreliable lead-free solder in order to solve what they think is a problem, it's a problem in name only, and the so-called solution is considerably worse than the old way of doing it. Maybe using lead-free solder on copper pipes inside of a house, maybe that's justified, but an awful lot of people are using PVC-like pipes these days inside the house. The good news of that is there's no solder joints anywhere. The bad news is now the grounding of your electronics is a lot more difficult in that house. So I would use conventional solder. So Rich, where are you located? And sounds to me like there's definitely a good way that you and John can get together. We'll soon find out, are you guys going to get together by email or telephone or whatever? I'm going to be looking up John from the roster in a minute to find out if his phone number is there. So where are you located, Rich? K2, Uncle Papa Sierra, I'm guessing in Pennsylvania. Probably moving 60 miles an hour. K2RIW in the TechNet. UPS Mobile, you got it, John. Hi, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Yeah, I'm on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. I just left Somerset, heading towards Carlisle. I've got to go into Manhattan, 43rd Street, and drop off the trailer and then be done. So I should be home around 6 a.m. with any luck. If he looks me up, if he's in a log, I'm in a log also. Otherwise, if he drops me an email at my call, kilo2unitedpapasierra@limoc.org, I'll get that, and then I'll get my phone number to him, and we can get in touch that way. But that's not a problem. As long as you've got all the equipment there, it should not take long at all. So, and I'm happy to do it. I'm located right on the Hicksville-Jellico border, right behind Sears. So that gives them some idea how close we are. Back to you, Dick.
I'm looking at the Limoc roster right now. KD2IXP has a listing for his website and his phone number in the Limoc roster. KTUPS has a website and a phone number. So you guys are well documented. So by way of the Limoc roster, you guys have got full documentation to talk to each other. Looks like we've got a solution here, John. KD2IXP, K2RIW and TechNet. Over to you, John, for any other information you want to add.
I appreciate it very much. And like I said, I have no objections to compensating the gentleman for his time and his expertise. You know, anything he wants short of gold bars, white slaves, and opium, and illegal guns I can provide. And I thank you very much. And help everybody has a wonderful and a safe Independence Day.
Yeah, Rich K2UPS has been around electronics a lot. I visited him when he was doing some of his mountain topping operation, as I call it, at West Hills Park. Got a beautiful setup by which he's got this expandable antenna he puts on his recreation vehicle, and he runs QRP, Morse code, sideband, and he's done a lot of ham radio. So you have your official soldering certificate, don't you, Rich? I'm having some fun with him. KTUPS, I bet you've soldered a lot of connectors like PL-259s on. K2UPS, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
I've done a few of them, probably a few dozen, I guess, total, but over, 30 years. So I'm sure we'll be able to get it all squared away for him. The earliest I'd probably get to do it, though, would be the end of this week, Friday, possibly Saturday. The next 2 days I'm busy with the holiday and family, and then I won't be home again until Friday. So, but we'll be in touch with the email. We'll work that all out. So no problem. And it's my pleasure to help you. KTUPS Mobile.
As they say, John, the price is right. Looks like you got a solution. Okay, time for the mailbag. And what kind of tough questions did we have this week, John? I had some really tough questions, tremendous number of them, on those field day sites that I visited last weekend. Boy, these guys, as you know, these guys with all their questions, they kept me up around the clock. I finally left the Gizbok site at around 1:30 in the afternoon, having been awake around the clock, 24 hours. I'm guessing those guys looked at a pretty grubby-looking guy at that time. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB, good evening, Dick, everyone on the net. And, we got a few questions here, and, not difficult, but these youngsters come up with some very interesting questions. I have a young man now, I'll let her drop, and I'm going to come back with a radar question, which I had the opportunity to ask, but I never even thought of this question. Let it drop. Okay, this has to do with shipboard radar. And as you know, I've been on many of those warships and in the CIC room, but never thought to ask this question. How useful is radar when they are approaching 40 and 50 foot ground swells? That antenna mast is leaning at sometimes at 35 degrees, 40 degrees, in that rolling and pitching environment. How is that radar useful? Does it still work? Interesting question. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Every radar antenna has a predictable horizontal beamwidth and vertical beamwidth of the antenna. Most of the antennas for radar are bat wing shape, which means they're considerably wider horizontally than they are vertically. Therefore, they've got a sharper beam in azimuth than they do in elevation. One of the world's best rough approximations that works extremely well is that you take a horn, a parabolic dish, or any other kind of antenna that has a clearly defined area, radio area. In the case of a parabolic dish that's used for a radar, the area of that dish is something your eye sees. You stand in front of that dish and look straight into it, you know the area. The dish might be, in the case of an ASR 7 or ASR 8 radar that's used at FAA sites at airports, that antenna is something in the vicinity of, I'm trying to remember now, I think they're around 15 feet wide and 10 feet high. Around 150 square feet, rough number. If you know the frequency that the radar works at, you and I can easily calculate the wavelength. Let me drop. You take the width of the antenna, divided by that wavelength. If, for instance, you happen to be using, I'm going to use a crazy example. If the radar is operating at a wavelength of 1 foot, and if your antenna is 15 feet wide, then let me make the antenna 10 feet wide. 1 foot wavelength, antenna is 10 feet wide. Calculate how many wavelengths wide is the antenna? 10 foot antenna, 1 foot wavelength, it's 10 wavelengths wide. Whatever the number of wavelengths is, you divide it into 70 degrees. That's an extremely good approximation as to the beamwidth in that direction. So in that radar antenna, in my silly example, which is a 1 foot wavelength, 10 foot wide, therefore it's 10 wavelengths wide, divide 10 into 70, you end up with 7. The horizontal beamwidth of that antenna is 7 degrees in that example. Let me drop. Because the antenna might only be 5 feet wide, and you can see that immediately you're going to get something like 14 degrees beamwidth. So you know the beamwidth of the antenna. You can estimate the amount of tilt of the mast as the airplane, as the boat goes into swells up and down. Depending on the sophistication of the radar, the antenna of the radar could be gimbaled. So so that the radar antenna is always aimed at the horizon, even though the ship is rolling and pitching and doing all kinds of things. So a sophisticated radar would move the dish, and particularly if the antenna on the ship is like in the ground, on the downrange trackers that were done on Mercury and Gemini. Let me drop it. Those antennas were looking up at the Apollo, they were looking up at the Mercury or Gemini satellite as it went by. And those antennas were gimbaled. And there was a great big fence around it because as the ship was pitching and the antenna is compensating, if you were in the wrong place, you could be hit with the antenna as it moves. So they had a fence around them. So sophisticated antennas will take out the roll and pitch of the ship. But if the roll and pitch isn't being taken out, and if the beamwidth of the antenna, in my example of a 7 degree total beamwidth, plus or minus 3.5 degrees, you pitch more than 3.5 degrees, and at least a half power point of the antenna is now aimed into that wave, so to speak. And so you're going to get a blank out on the range of the radar during that period of time. And the amount of blockage you get from a wave, if it's a great big wave and the ship is not yet pitching, you would think that the wave is going to stop the signal. Let me drop the signal. Very similar to a situation I know of where somebody was doing outdoor lighting with RF circuitry. He wanted to transmit a signal to his outdoor lighting, and he's got the shrubs and berms and whatever on the property. And optically speaking, a berm looks like it's a thorough blockage to a radio signal. Well, not really. That radio signal crawls over the top of that berm and wraps around it, so to speak. And the berm is making you some number of decibels of attenuation of that particular path. Optically, you've got blockage. Radio-wise, you'd be amazed how difficult it is to block a radio wave. Just putting up a berm that's right in the main beam of the antenna, you think it's going to stop the signal? It probably is going to knock down the signal 3 or 4 dB. The signal is going to wrap around that berm. And to some degree, it wraps around that wave, if you know what I mean. So even though the wave looks like a blockage, it may not be. So these are some of the solutions: gimbaling the antenna and letting the RF wave wrap around the water waves in the junk. Stopping a radio signal is very difficult. Multipath is everywhere, if you know what I mean. KC2WGB, KQIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yeah, you know, for aircraft, I don't see that being a problem. But for looking for vessel traffic, that could be an issue with those groundswells if they were in close support. But I was just wondering about that. But yeah, gimbaling the antenna could help probably in a large degree. But yeah, I thought it was an interesting question. All right, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the next one.
WS1.
All recognized, get you in a minute. If you've got a well-designed radar and you're worried about nearby traffic, John, the radar might have a range of 200 miles. The nearby traffic you're worried about avoiding might be 2 or 20 miles away from you. And the radar signal falls off 12 dB per octave every time you double the range to the target. The amount of echo you get from the target goes down by 12 decibels. Well, you compare a 200-mile range radar to a traffic that's 10 miles away, you're getting such an extremely potent echo from that local traffic that you can tolerate 10 and 20 dB of extra attenuation because of the rolling of the ship and the blockage of a wave, and you're still going to see that target. The nice thing about a radar is that the things that are displayed on the screen are a function of how much time it takes for the signal to go out there and come back, and how strong is that echo. How strong is the echo tells you how bright it's going to be on that screen, and how far out from the center of the screen is how much time. So even though you've got a wave that's blocking you, the amount of timing of that signal bypassing that wave, crawling over the top of that water wave, let me drop it. That signal's crawling over the top of that water wave and still going the exact same distance, per se, out to the target and coming back. Therefore, that target is going to paint on your screen in the exact same location, even when the water wave is there. The only effect you'll see is the effect of the water wave giving you partial blockage means that the target will paint on the screen not quite as bright, but you're still going to see it. So if the main function of your radar is to make sure You're not hitting local traffic in the fog. Even a rolling sea, that radar is still going to give you damn good information 98% of the time, in my opinion. WS2N, K2LIW, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, okay, Dick, I think that was the best explanation I've ever heard for the beam width. But now you're talking about radar. I'm hoping, and I hope it is, holds true for regular transmissions, you know, let's say on any kind of a, you know, transmission, not necessarily radar, just regular data from the satellites, you know, if you have a certain diameter and antenna, and you take that wavelength and do what you said to it, and then divide by 70, does that come up true for, you know, I would imagine it's for everything, I hope it is. Back to you, Dick.
It's the laws of physics, Paul. It works for every antenna. If you know the approximate width horizontally and the approximate width vertically of the emitting surface of that antenna, you can make an extremely good approximate beam width prediction of the signal coming out of the antenna. An ordinary dipole, half wavelength wide, in many cases has a horizontal beam width of something like 100 degrees, 120 degrees. A vertical beam width of 360 degrees. In other words, a horizontal dipole radiates beautifully straight up, straight down, straight forward, straight back. So it's got an elevation beam width of 360. It's got an azimuth beam width of something like 100 degrees, 110 degrees. So all antennas you've ever used. I'll admit that the formula gets a little bit vague when it comes to an antenna that's kind of hard to describe. What is the horizontal width like a dipole? So if you predicted 90 degrees or 120 degrees, and it's really 100, it's close enough. It's the right ballpark. You start using that formula on the antenna that's inside of your cell phone, which is working on all of these bands, and it's forced to operate in a very compact space. Let me drop quick. You'll find out that cell phone antenna is almost omnidirectional. It is such a small fraction of a wavelength wide and high. It has no appreciable beam width. It's almost an isotropic radiator. Oh, it may have a little bit of a null off the right-hand side and off the left-hand side of its dipole-like structure, if that's what it is. And if they put the right kind of zigzags in there, even those nulls disappear. You'd be amazed how much time is wasted taking cell phones and putting them into a very elaborate machine. All of a sudden, I can't think of the name of it. It'll come to me in a minute. There's a machine where you put the cell phone in there and slowly rotate it, and with 64 individual receiving sites, you pick up all the three-dimensional antenna patterns. And so everybody puts their cell phone into this machine to plot this very expensive antenna three-dimensional pattern. I call it an apple plot, because it usually has the majority of the three-dimensional pattern. It looks like an apple with a dimple on the top where the stem would come out, if you know what I mean. And so if they use this machine to measure the total radiated power, which is really a function of antenna efficiency and antenna gain, then the machine is telling them something useful. But if you think the machine is giving you useful information about the antenna pattern and the gain in various directions, let me drop it. You're essentially wasting your time, because you've got so few beam widths of antenna dimension inside of that cell phone. It doesn't have an antenna pattern. It doesn't have the raw ingredients to have any significant amount of gain in any one direction. It's almost an isotropic radiator. Over to you, Paul, for any comments on this. WS2N, K2IW, and the TechNet.
Okay, now, I got what I needed. That's good. I like the description. I like taking the wavelengths. When you started in with 15 feet, and then you said, wait a minute, let me make it 10 feet, and then the wavelength was 1 foot, we're going to divide it by 10. Take that number, 10, and divide it into 70. I said, wow, that's round numbers, you know, ballpark figures. That's the way I am. Very well done. Back to you, Dick.
NY2H Mobile.
Lou recognized. To a real engineer, 90% of the time, getting the second and third decimal place doesn't matter. If I take that hose in my backyard and I think I'm going to fill my pool with it, all I want to know is ballpark. That hose filling my pool, I want to know, is it going to take a day or is it going to take a month? In some cases, depending on the diameter of the hose and the size of my pool, to fill my pool with that garden hose might take a month. So getting round ballpark figures, in many cases, is most of the information you really need. Over to you, NY2H, KQRIW, you got it.
Alrighty, good evening. Yeah, John had mentioned he did some work in the CIC. I was with Sperry on a project involving the CIC. And I remember, I think it was the Mark 92 radar, which is a 3D radar. In other words, azimuth and elevation. They rotate for azimuth. And I believe they swept frequency and excited different resonant elements for the elevation. So I think in that instance, you might have a little more of a problem. I understand with the 2D, you know, you're going to get the spot in the same location, albeit maybe a little less intense. But I think in that carrier group environment, you know, you're working with a little more stringent situation. Back to that.
Not necessarily, Lou. There's a kind of antenna that's frequently used on a radar where it is a slot-phased array, and there's a certain spacing in between all the slots, and the slots are being fed, let's say, with vertical pieces of waveguide. As you sweep the frequency, the slots that are further away from the end of the waveguide, as you sweep up in frequency, those slots are at a larger number of wavelengths away, therefore they're going to get the signal delayed in phase. And therefore, as you sweep in frequency, the beam in my example would be sweeping upwards. So you can sweep the beam as a function of frequency. But still, at each instant of time, at each frequency where you're using that antenna, it has a certain amount of height to all the emitting slots. It's got a certain amount of width to all the emitting slots. And although the beams may be sweeping in AS or L, depending on how you design the feed network, that rough approximation for the beam width will still come out the same number, loop at each instant of time. What is the beam width of the sweeping beam? And so you can still calculate that. And if you tell me how many wavelengths is in that waveguide between the bottom where it's being fed and the top of each of these vertical columns of slots, you tell me how many megacycles you're sweeping from point A to point B. You know, I'm sweeping from 400 to 500 megacycles. And you tell me how many feet is along that waveguide, I can predict for you how many degrees you're going to be sweeping. Every phased array steers the beam in the direction of the delay. Let me drop it. But at your center frequency, the antenna radiates broadside, normal to your array, plane of your array. And now you sweep to a higher frequency where the upper elements are now more delayed compared to the lower elements, that beam is now going to be swept up in elevation. A phased array steers the beam in the direction of the delayed elements. It's a very handy thing to remember. So these rough rules of thumb, Lou, in my opinion, they still keep right on working. NY2H, K2RIW in the TechNet, because at each instant of time, whether you're sweeping the frequency or not, at each instant of time, that radio wave doesn't know the difference. You got it, Lou.
So my feeling is that the elevation angle, in other words, as you sweep the frequency, each segment of frequency is related to a particular elevation angle, and if the ship is pitching, it would seem to me that you would get higher intensity at an elevation angle determined in part by the pitch rather than, you know, a horizontal position. So I don't know, but that was just my two cents. I am almost in my driveway. I'll listen out. NY2H Mobile, back to that.
In your example of a frequency swept array, which is being swept elevation-wise in frequency, as the ship is rolling, the apparent elevation of your display is going to change. But if now you want to design an alternate radar, and you don't want to go through all the rigmarole of putting in gimbals on that antenna, but you've got some kind of a sensor that tells you how much the ship has rolled and how much the ship has pitched, you therefore can take the frequency swept signal, which is sweeping the beam, and compensate. If you know you're sweeping temperature is going to be 10 degrees up. But the ship has to be pitched, just happens to be pitching down 10 degrees. You can subtract the 10 degrees before you display it. So as long as you've got a sensor that knows the pitch and roll of the ship, and you know the way you're sweeping the beam in azimuth and elevation, you can use that to compensate, and therefore the display will stay fixed even though the ship is rolling and pitching. There's radars that do that, Lou. NY2H, K2IW, and TechNet.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. So that's the added complexity. So, you know, your description of the 2D was fine, but the 3D, you need this additional compensation. So, very good.
As you guys can tell, the word radar is a very innocent-sounding word. But in modern-day electronics, boy, there are a zillion ways of making a radar. That electronically sweeps in azimuth and elevation, electronically sweeps in polarization, electronically creates various front-to-back ratios. There's a kind of a radar that that only transmits a little bit of, it transmits tensile beams in space, and it only transmits tensile beams in the direction of the targets that it is tracking, and is sequentially going through all of those targets and keeping track of where they are. And each beam is looking at a target that's moving, and each beam stays centered on that moving target. It's hopping between all of those beams to keep track of all of those targets. Track well, scan, mode is one of the very famous techniques that was used a zillion years ago. So anything you can dream about in electronics with antennas, transmitters, receivers, pulse duration, pulse rip rate, pulse chirp rate, coded signals within the pulse, anything you can dream about, somebody has already built that kind of a radar, in my opinion. KC2WGB, K2LAW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB, very interesting you should mention that. The Phalanx system actually does that. It will track the aircraft, identify a friend or foe with transponders. It will also track the projectiles at the same time and adjust the weapon to fit the target rate. Good stuff. By the way, there was another antenna I was exposed to. It was approximately 12 foot wide. It was like a panel antenna, but not a panel antenna. It had multiple antennas on the face of it. It was 12 foot wide and about 4 foot high. It rotated in azimuth, and at the same time, it went up and down in elevation. So its beam was actually traveling in the clouds like a triangle waveform generator. I don't know what the purpose of that was. I know it was a test, but that was an interesting antenna to see it operate.
Yeah, there's a kind of radar using that technique. They call it a height finder radar. So of all the targets it finds, it also displays how high each one of those targets are. It knows the range of the target. It knows the apparent angle where that target appears to be from your radar's point of view. It goes through the trigonometry of that and says, hey, that target is 10,000 feet off the ground. Over to John, KQIW.
Oh, very good. Like you say, there's so many different types and so much information coming down to that CIC room on a ship. It's just incredible. They have situational awareness of, in 360 in all directions. It is just amazing. All right, let me let it drop. I'll go on to the next one. Okay, I have two young gentlemen that basically are asking the same question. They both have Helicrafter Model 85s, which is very old. They were found in the attic or basement. They haven't been used in years. They hooked them up, and they're working, okay? What they're asking is the antenna. So they're basically getting into shortwave listening, which not too many people are doing today. But their question basically comes to this. One gentleman says he can place an antenna his antenna altitude is going to be about 75 feet, which is pretty high. And he can run an antenna between trees at a 50-foot length. If he changes it, that would be northwest to southeast. He can do another one 100 foot from northeast to southwest. And could he feed both of them with one coaxial cable? He's trying to use coax to eliminate noise. He thinks it'll be a little quieter that way. Or would he be better off just running one long loop, which could be as much as 300 feet? What do you think? Maybe you can help him out with designing that type of antenna. Seems that he has plenty of area. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Each individual antenna, John, has got its advantages and disadvantages. For certain HF signals that arrive at certain polarizations from certain azimuth and elevation angles, most of the shortwave signals you listen to have been bounced, I use the word bounced in quotes, off of that ionosphere. They've really been reflected off of that plasma that we call ionosphere. And that ionosphere plasma is a mixture of a conducting medium which has the Earth's magnetic field in it. And when you mix a plasma with magnetic field, you get what's called Faraday rotation. The bottom line is that that signal you're listening to from that broadcast station in Germany, by the time it comes to you, it has been through that ionosphere, it's bounced, so to speak, off that ionosphere and off the ocean a couple of times to get to you. And each time it goes through the ionosphere, it experiences some polarization rotation. We drop it. So even though that signal started off as a vertically polarized broadcast station, by the time that signal gets to you, it's been twisted a couple of times in polarization while it's propagating, and it might arrive in your backyard horizontal today, and tomorrow it might arrive in your backyard vertical, depending on the state of the ionosphere and what the sunspots are doing and what solar prominence is doing and so on. The bottom line of all this is that if you've got the ability to put up two separate pieces of wire, one north-south and one east-west, one is an inverted V and one's an L shape and whatever, feeding them with separate pieces of coax gives you one hell of an advantage. Because while you're doing listening, you unplug one antenna and plug in the other. Depending on the direction of arrival, the frequency, and the time of day, which antenna is going to give you the best reception of that signal today is something you can find out by flipping back and forth between the two. Wire is usually inexpensive. You can fill up your backyard and all the trees with two, three, and four pieces of wire fed with two, three, and four pieces of coax cable and build a great big rotary switch. And at HF frequencies, let me drop this. That rotary switch that selects the individual antennas doesn't have to be a fancy coaxial switch. Receivers are extremely forgiving at HF frequencies. A simple single-pole, four-throw switch, wafer-type rotary switch in a metallic box. Doesn't even have to be a metallic box. It'll work a little bit better if it's a metallic box. Allows you to have one piece of cable going into the receiver, four coax cables going to the four antennas in the backyard, and they go to the four positions on a single-pole, four-throw switch. And you rotate the switch, and you listen to antenna number one, number two, number three, number four today. And you can gather some beautiful information by listening to those individual antennas, which have individual altitudes, individual orientations, individual slant angles, individual lengths. Each has its advantage. And the exact length of the antenna on HF reception is not very important. You'd be amazed how much HF reception you can do by picking up a random length of clip lead wire, simply plugging it into the center conductor of the connector on the receiver, and the rest of the piece of wire a couple of feet long lays on the wooden table. You get beautiful reception. The signal strength meter, let me drop it. Because your antenna is so short and non-resonant, and it probably has a 50 to 1 standing wave ratio if you were transmitting into it, so it might have 15 or 20 dB of extra loss because of its standing wave ratio. That means the signal you want to listen to is 10 or 15 dB weaker. The noise of the atmosphere is also 10 or 15 dB weaker. Therefore, the signal-to-noise ratio, what you hear, can be beautiful, even though the signal strength meter doesn't go up very high. Receivers are very forgiving. At HF frequencies, the main thing you care about is signal-to-noise ratio, and most of the noise is not coming from the receiver. It's coming from the environment. That ionosphere allows you to propagate those signals way beyond Earth curvature. That's the good news. But that ionosphere, let me drop it. That ionosphere is filled up with a bunch of cosmic rays, it's filled up with a bunch of lightning bolts. Somewhere on planet Earth, in every second, there are probably 15 lightning backyard. So the real noise of the environment, and I don't mean environment in your backyard, I mean the world, the radio noise of the world combined to the signals that you want to listen to from that world give you a certain signal to noise ratio, and if your particular antenna happens to favor the direction of the signal reception and the polarization of the signal today at this hour, then that signal climbs further above the noise and sounds more pleasant. So fill up your backyard with wire if you want to experiment with radio and receivers. Don't combine the antennas. You'd like to go to individual antennas because each will have an advantage depending on what frequency you're listening to, what direction, what time of day, and what day of the week. KC2WGV, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGV. Very good, Dick. I'm sure they'll be happy with that. These youngsters are really getting into shortwave listening, and I hope they're successful. But he's got a great yard and a lot of area to put up his... I guess he could put 5-6 of those antennas. And all of that, like you said, wire is cheap, and a little switch, I'm sure he could have a ball. All right, let me go to drop, and I'll go on to my last one. All right, this is a waveguide question from a youngster. What did I drop? Okay, he was trying to follow some of the conversations on waveguide that we were having, and he came up with an interesting question, I think it is. He's looking at, say, WR90. Okay, so it's 0.9 and 0.45 in its measurements between the A and B wall. He looks at the waveform drawing of an E and H wave. They seem to be the same amplitude. Why is there a difference in the spacing between the A and B walls? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Waveguide will only propagate a signal if it's a vertically polarized signal, and if you've got the waveguide laying flat on the table so that the broad wall is parallel to the table. The horizontal width between those two vertical walls, and the short walls, the distance between them, has to be a half wavelength or greater, or the signal will not go down that waveguide. It'll have huge amounts of attenuation, more than 10 dB per waveguide length, so to speak. Every couple of inches, every inch you'll get 10 dB of loss if you're below cutoff frequency on WR90. So the width is very important. It's got to be greater than a half wavelength. The height is not very important. You could make 0.45 inch height. You could bring that down to 0.1 inch if you wanted to, and it'll still propagate a beautiful signal. Let me drop it. However, when you bring that height down, the apparent impedance of the waveguide becomes a smaller number. It might represent a little bit more difficulty of you matching the waveguide to coax adapter, and it'll arc over at a lower amount of power because the vertically polarized wave, we've got a higher and higher power. The first arc over you're going to get in the waveguide is the center of the broad wall above and the center of the broad wall below. There's going to be an arc between those two. That's where the maximum voltage is. When you see a plot of voltage versus width across the guide, when the signal is going down there, it's a half sine wave. The signal, the vertically polarized signal, is almost zero at the left-hand vertical wall, almost zero at the right-hand vertical wall, and maximum in the center. So it's a half sine wave of signal if you plot that signal amplitude versus position. And at first that sounds crazy. If you've got a zigzag signal going down there, how could it have that waveform? Let me drop it. And that's because the zigzag is a double zigzag. It's like a pair of scissors that's been opened a certain distance and shoved down the waveguide. Along the blade of the signal is zigzag number one. Along the other blade of those scissors is zigzag number two. So those two signals are, there's one bouncing left to right and one bouncing right to left at this position at this instant of time. And that zigzag bouncing signal that we estimated one of those bounces with a pair of scissors is only one instant of time. That whole crazy waveform slides down the waveguide as if you're sliding the signal, the scissors down the waveguide at the group velocity of the wave. The whole crazy waveform goes down the guide. Very similar to what happens with the coax. one instant of time. A fraction of a nanosecond later, that whole waveform will all be shifted to the right, downwave in the signal in the transmission line. So all of these waveforms you can draw are one instant of time, and these waveforms are all moving. So you can take the height of that waveguide and make it as short as you like. You're going to lower and lower impedance, lower and lower power level, and a little more insertion loss, because the signal is bouncing off those vertical walls. If it's got less and less vertical walls to bounce off of, it's going to have more insertion loss. Take that in the other direction. You can take a piece of WR90 waveguide, where the height is 0.45 inches. You could make that height 5 inches if you wanted to. You can buy that waveguide. It's called Tall Guide. Let me drop it. When you do that, the insertion loss of that waveguide goes extremely low. Tall guide has very little insertion loss. That's the good news. You're now bouncing left and right off those very great big tall vertical walls. You get very little insertion loss. That's the good news. The bad news, you've got to be very careful how you launch that signal, because it is now multiple wavelengths of height. There are other bouncing modes that you can launch if you're a little bit uncareful. You've got to very slowly taper into tall guide and very slowly taper back out of it, so to speak. But during that length, the tall guide will have very little insertion loss and a considerably higher impedance, by the way. So it's a rare item, but you can buy tall guide if you want very little loss. Over to you, John. Waveguide is crazy stuff. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
Well, I can understand how he developed that question, looking at that waveform of the E and the H wave, and thinking both of them would have to have the same height. So, interesting. Okay, very good. That's it from the mailbag. Let's go over to Paul and see what's happening in space. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick.
Probably in the last few days, I've gone through quite a few sites to give me more and more information about Juno, a spacecraft that's going to encounter Jupiter tomorrow night, our time, at around 11:15 or something like that, is when it's going to do that 35-minute burn of its main rocket to insert itself into Jupiter orbital insertion. And I can find lots of information about all of the fancy machines that are on board, what the orbits are going to look like, and whatever. Very difficult to find out the diameter of the main parabolic dish, and I have the impression that the main parabolic dish, one of its main sources of use, is going to be aimed straight down at Jupiter to probe the atmosphere and probe the clouds. That the high-gain parabolic dish is not only going to be used to aim signals back toward Mother Earth. So the diameter of that dish, I can sort of estimate it by looking at a man standing by, and I guess it's something in the vicinity of 8 feet or so in diameter, maybe more. So it's very difficult to find a website that will give you that specific information or the number of watts of the transmitter. WS2N, with space report number 208, K2IW and TechNet. You've got it, Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N. Well, the main bus of the satellite is, what, 11.5 by 11.5. It's just a, it's a six-sided spacecraft, and that whole antenna takes up that, almost that whole surface area, so it looks like 10 feet. I think I remember reading 3 point something meters a while back, but let's call it 10 feet, again, round numbers for me. And, I had a few other things I want to mention first. I know Juno is the main topic, of course, but we have an American going into space via Soyuz rocket coming up this Thursday, and that will be also on NASA TV. And I heard you talking about using satellites to try to get the signal from NASA. On any computer now, you could download the usually an app on the tablets or on a computer. You could download it. Just one click on any of my computers or tablets, and I'm on NASA TV. So that that's very doable. And you know, I'll be able to do that Thursday night at 9:36 when they launch from Kazakhstan. Yeah, the American is from Connecticut. You know, Austin, originally Kathleen Rubens, expert biology and all, and her first flight up, she's going up with the Russian who'll be flying it. His second flight, he'll be flying the Soyuz, and then somebody from JAXA, that's JAXA is the Japanese version of NASA, and they're sending somebody up, so he's going up. So Kate Rubens and her two partners will be launching on Thursday, and you know, they practice for these adventures for about 2 years. She'll be doing spacewalk up there. Looking forward to the ITER that comes up in a couple of months. The ITER is the International Docking Adapter that was lost during the SpaceX explosion a little over a year ago, just over a year ago. And now another one will go up to replace that. That will be attached to one of the nodes. And once attached, you'll be able to send from American soil American astronauts to the International Space Station. We have two planned spacecraft that'll be doing that, and that'll be SpaceX Dragon Crew version and Boeing Starliner, both now being constructed. You'll probably see the first, probably one of them, maybe the end of next year. You'll probably see a test flight, first unmanned, and then a manned flight. And the unmanned flight will actually dock with the space station. Just, you know, it'll duplicate a manned flight. It'll dock and stay up there for a period of time, and then it'll come back. And then after that, you'll have a manned flight. And then they'll have one right after the other once they get going. So I'm looking forward to the Soyuz launch on Thursday. I want to mention there's a mineral that the Mars Curiosity rover found on Mars called tridymite, and it's unexpected by the scientists to find this stuff. It's usually found in a volcanic debris, you know, high temperatures, and they didn't think any such thing was going on in Mars history in the last couple of million years or so, and because they found it with their Curiosity with the chem lab, and they tested for it. Curiosity is still doing a great job, which landed in 2000, and it's almost 4 years now, so it's 2012, still doing a good job, looking to get higher up on Mount Shaw. Let me drop it to WS2S. Last week I wanted to watch that booster being tested out in Utah. I did watch that on the NASA channel, and that was the booster that's going to be used for the SLS, the Space Launch System, NASA's future launch capability. Will be the SLS Space Launch System, which consists of the big tank, the solid booster rockets, two of them, and on top of that you'll have the Orion spacecraft with a launch abort system attached to that. The launch abort system is built by Orbital ATK, and so are these boosters. They're really, you know, launch the whole idea of boosters is really to ignite them and to deliver a tremendous amount of thrust to get this SLS tank off the ground. The SLS tank is going to contain liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, and it's bigger than the external tanks that we used to have on the space shuttle. So to get that fuel off the ground, and that fuel is feeding the engines that are feeding the rocket that's going to be pushing the Orion spacecraft not only to lunar orbit, eventually to Mars orbit. Well, to make a long story short, this rocket went off for 2 minutes, and it was pretty impressive. It didn't go anywhere. They have it bolted down on 3 million pounds of concrete, but it was still pretty cool to watch. They had about 10,000 people out there to watch the
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Time goes fast when you're having fun. It's the second time that it's been tested in the last year. Last March, they tested it one other time, and this time they tested it at a chilled down version. They wanted to get the whole thing down to around 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And that took about a month. They encapsulated it in this big cooling unit and removed that. And then lit this thing off. So it was very successful. All the reports came back. It's very good. And the next time we'll actually see that launch, there'll be two of them, and they'll be standing vertically instead of horizontally, like this thing was laying down in the mountains of Utah. They'll be standing vertically attached to the SLS Orion system, an unmanned flight, and that will be probably the end of 2018, so a little over 2 years from now, we'll get a chance to see that thing launch. It'll go out to the moon, hang out there for a couple of weeks, and eventually the capsule will come back. After that, they plan on having manned missions. Now to get back to Juno, that's tomorrow night, like you were saying, Dick. Juno will be going into Jupiter insertion orbit, and it'll be a 35-minute burn. And this thing, it's got big solar panels on it, so the solar panels themselves are very heavy. It's got three sets of solar panels. Like I said, it was the bus of this spacecraft is designed. It's got six sides. So three of those sides have these 8-foot-wide solar panels coming out from them. And each one is a little, around 30 feet long. And they're very heavy. Collectively, they weigh over 700 pounds. And why are they so heavy? They need to be very strong because this is a spinning spacecraft. It was launched back in 2011, and when it left Earth, the last rocket that was attached to it started to spin on purpose, and it kept it at roughly a little over one revolution per minute, and that was kept like that all through the cruise phase. Now, when they get near Jupiter, which they are now, it's going to start spinning up to about 5 revolutions per minute, and they need the panels to be very strong because the centrifugal force is going to increase. But by doing that, it keeps it very stable. And then they're going to put the rocket in a forward position and light it off. This rocket is built by European Space Agency. It actually comes out of England. The LEROS 1B rocket, LEROS. And they've blown many of these things in the past. They've used them to slow down Curiosity when it got near Mars and dozens of other flights. But it's pretty reliable. It has a hydrazine, nitric texoxide fuel. When they mix together, they instantly ignite. You don't need a spark plug. When they open a valve, that's it. It comes on. So it's very reliable. But, certain things could shut this thing down. They're worried about JPL is worried about this thing getting into orbit. They're going to go very close to Jupiter. 3,000 miles above the cloud tops. Now, to do that safely, you're going into a strong radiation area. Like I've mentioned it in the past, that they have protection. They have a titanium ball surrounding all the important electronics, and that should protect it from the radiation to some degree, but not 100%. You know, in fact, over time, over the 20-month period, they expect it to degrade quite a bit. But in the meantime, if any electronics do start to get fried, for some, you know, they don't think it's going to happen, but if it does, the computer is designed to restart. What will happen is, let's say a component gets affected. Normally, if it was during its regular mission, it would shut itself down, and then it would look for the stars, face the spacecraft toward Earth, and, you know, pick up a signal. They don't want to do that this time. If something happens, they want the computer to ignore anything. What they'll do is, you know, they want to keep the engine running, and for some reason, if the engine does shut down, because some electronic glitch, automatically the engine will come back on again. So they need to run again. 35 minutes, no matter what happens, it's going to shut down. But I think with all these safeguards, it should be able to go into orbit. Last Thursday, they sent a command to shut down everything except the engine. So nothing will be on. It's using all its power. It's got 405 watts that's being generated by the solar panels, half of which is used to keep the spacecraft electronics warm, and the other half is used for the to charge batteries and keep it going. So I expect it to go into a polar orbit starting tomorrow night, late tomorrow night, and then it'll go over the top first, over the north, and then over the south, and then after that it'll come out on the other side 6 hours later. And hopefully they'll hear a signal. They have it set up where they should hear a couple of beeps, I think three beeps over a couple of second period. And if they hear that, they know it's successfully made it to the, you know, to the other side without, you know, going into the clouds of Jupiter and burning up. We'll see what happens. It'll start off with a couple of month orbit, and eventually it'll work its way down to an 11-day orbit. That's going to take quite a while. Officially, it won't start doing real science until October, mid-October. But in the meantime, it does have Juno Cam on there. Juno Cam is a camera that will be taking pictures. They call it the people's camera. You know, people vote. You can get on a website and vote what parts of Jupiter you want to take pictures of. So, there you go, Dick. That's some of the information. There's a lot more. Got a lot of fuel. Half the weight of this thing, which is roughly, let's call it around 7,000 pounds. A little less than half is fuel. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. Back to you, Dick, for any questions on this or the other space topics. K2RIWWS2S.
And Juno is an interesting spacecraft, Paul. Jupiter is so much bigger than the Earth, and it's got the strongest magnetic field of any planet in this solar system. So the combination of a very large planet and a very large magnetic field, and for zillions of years the Sun has been spitting out solar wind, positively charged particles, at numbers like 1,000,000 miles an hour, sometimes up to 4,000,000 miles an hour during a solar prominence. So the Sun is continuously boiling off tremendous amount. I forget how many tons per second, but it's a big number. So the Sun is continuously pouring out these particles. A good number of those particles get collected by the Earth's magnetic field and create the inner Van Allen belt of positive charged particles and the outer Van Allen belt of negative charged particles. And these belts are spherical objects that go between the North Pole and the South Pole. And those particles in those belts are bouncing back and forth between the North Pole